The Playlist with Fiona Williams.
It's like he's going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. He's going to find some way to win, even when it seems impossible.
Hello, and welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I'm head of curation at SBS On Demand, and I also manage our online coverage of movies and TV here at SBS. Long-time listeners of the show would note that it's been a long time between episodes, but look, thank you for staying subscribed. But we are back. Well, I'm back, and I'm going to be leaning into the aspect of my job that I absolutely love, which is having the chance to talk to filmmakers, actors, and creators about their work. You know, teasing out the broader themes at play on screen and the stories about how certain scenes, moments, and story elements have all come to be. So if you'll indulge me, and if you can put up with my long and sometimes rambling questions, join me for these interviews and conversations with special guests, like the ones coming up today, which I hope can act as a bit of a companion to a new show or a movie, often one that's streaming at SBS On Demand. Because there's a reason we make these shows or that we bring them to you, because there's so much more that can be said about them beyond the literal story that's playing out on screen. So I hope you love this as much as I do in bringing it to you. Now, today we've got a pretty spectacular documentary series we're going to be talking about, which is the definitive story of the life, the career, and the legacy of Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali was an activist who fought to move America in a certain way.
I have too much to fight for, cause to fight for.
There was going to be an enormous price to pay for that.
Boxing was this much of his evolution. The person he is today is way bigger.
The price of freedom comes high. I have paid, but I am free.
Muhammad Ali is a four-part documentary event. And I'm not kidding about the event bit because it's 8 hours in total. It's epic in its scale, but it's also intimate in the way it teases out the details about this incredible life. And it kind of needs that larger canvas because in order to tell the complete story of the man, his faith, which is central, his career, his ego, and his moral compass. Because what it really tells is the story of Ali's quest to redefine what black leadership looked like and what being a Muslim man in America looked like, talked like, and acted like. You might know some aspects of the story, or think you do, like I did, but it's engrossing to witness the various ways that Ali's life story encapsulates the profound challenges of America in the mid to late 20th century, and equally draws a line to the struggle for justice, which continues through to this day. Muhammad Ali comes to SBS from the stable of filmmaking by no less than Ken Burns. Friend of the show, Ken Burns, who you can find in the archives of this podcast when we chatted about the Vietnam War a couple of years ago. Now, Ken Burns directs this series with his eldest daughter, Sarah Burns, and her husband, David McMahon, and they're going to be joining me in just a minute. And Sarah and David's work on Muhammad Ali, for which they are co-directors, co-producers, and also the writers of the central story that weaves this incredible life together across the four episodes. Now, it builds upon their body of work that includes their chronicle of the profound racism and decades-long miscarriage of justice within the story of the Central Park Five, and their biography of baseball player and civil rights icon Jackie Robinson. And Muhammad Ali is very much in the tradition of this work, where they centre the stories of black men with biographies that examine American history, and which importantly hold a mirror to the racism that is embedded within all of that. And they feature 45 interview subjects in this series from some of Ali's opponents. It includes his daughters, a couple of ex-wives, sports writers, promoters, but also poets and authors and present-day prize fighters who all speak to Ali's legacy and his imprint upon them. The documentary screens on SBS Sunday nights and is available to stream at SBS On Demand as well. It is a fantastic binge, and I must say I devoured all four episodes in just a couple of sittings because it's just, it's big, but it runs at a clip and it's incredible. Anyway, I could keep talking, but why would I when I've got the directors just here ready to go? So it's a great chat. So let's get into it and welcome Sarah Burns and David McMahon to The Playlist.
Thank you. It's such a big life that you're that you're covering, and you give it the time and the scope to do justice to all the many facets of your subject's incredible life. I'd love to maybe start with, you know, the fact he is one of the most recognisable people of the late 20th century, and much is known, but maybe not to this level of scrutiny. But how do you approach that sort of when he is such a figure in the public eye to then dive deep to find new ways to tell the story?
You know, we come in, for us, it's always a process of discovery ourselves. So even if whether we know something about the subject or not, we're sort of starting with a blank slate and trying to really understand something about who this person was and what makes, in this case, him so important and so interesting, so compelling, why we're still interested in him today. And so we start from that perspective. And what we want to do is tell a story that really makes our subject, in doing biography, that makes Muhammad Ali a three-dimensional, real person. And so that means going beyond what there's obviously so much material about Ali out there, but often those things have focused on a single chapter in his life. One fight, you know, his battle with the U.S. government over his draft resistance, things like that. And it felt to us like being able to do it on this scale, to do this larger portrait where we could tie together all those different threads and understand the relationship between his faith, for example, and his boxing career, his draft resistance, and understand his family life and sort of who he was at home at the same time, was a way to really get to know Ali in a different way and in a deeper way.
And on that, in approaching it, did the themes come first and you sort of wrote and sought out interviews based on that, or did the themes emerge as you where do you start, I guess, is the question.
I think all of the above. I mean, we have an incredibly long timeline to work on this, thanks to our association with public television, with Ken Burns. And that's essential, I think, to our process of uncovering what those themes will be. And so this was going to be obviously a story of an athlete, a celebrated athlete who achieved more than most ever do in their careers. But quickly, we discovered this was also a spiritual journey. And a lot in his life, the decisions he makes, the places that he goes, what happens around him is informed by this spiritual journey. And so he's raised in segregated Louisville, Kentucky. And everything around him signals that he's not going to have the same opportunities as white people. His father is a painter, but he doesn't get the same commissions as white painters. His father tells him, you'll never be able to be rich because of the color of your skin. So from an early age, he's informed that he's not going to have these same chances. As a teenager, he discovers the Nation of Islam. And the message is there, one, that black people should have dignity. Black people should do for themselves. And the Nation of Islam, it's founded by a man named W.D. Farad, but it's picked up by another man named the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And his message resonates for young Cassius Clay. And it helps make sense of the segregated world that he lives in. But in joining as a teenager this sect, this religious sect, this separatist sect, he begins a lifelong spiritual journey, and it evolves along the way. And you can see him in a boxing ring before he goes into a fight. He says a prayer. When he refuses induction into the U.S. Army, it's informed by the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, who himself had refused induction into the army and gone to jail during the Second World War. Later in life, as the Nation of Islam takes a turn towards more mainstream Islam, Muhammad Ali goes in that direction as well. And towards the end of his life, he seems to be trying to make sense of his life and legacy through a religious lens. He wants to know, did I do enough that when I reach the gates of paradise, I'm going to be admitted? And he's thoughtful about his flaws, what he got right and what he got wrong. So thematically, one thing that really began to make sense for us quickly is to see this through the lens of a man on a spiritual journey.
And that's really one aspect that really has not been examined. I mean, you know, with bravado, everyone knows the high talk, and of course the fighting. But especially in episode two, I guess, where you really examine Ali's relationship with Malcolm X and the deeper, or the wider context of the end of their friendship. Can we dwell a little on that, sort of the details within that, and what you learned out of the process as well?
Yeah, the relationship with Malcolm X was always going to be an important part of telling the story and really understanding how that relationship evolved and, of course, how it ended, how their friendship kind of broke apart, and the complexities of Ali's relationship with Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X, and sort of how he was sort of torn between them at that point is a really interesting part of his evolution and his that spiritual journey as well, and his personal story. And so we were really interested in doing that, and we wanted to make sure that we could give, I mean, there's a lot of important context to understanding this part of the story, both to understand, as Dave was saying, sort of the origins of the Nation of Islam and of Elijah Muhammad, and why that might have appealed to young Cassius Clay, what it was that helped him, how it helped him make sense of the world around him, and then his relationship with Malcolm X and who Malcolm X was. So we have a little mini biography of Malcolm X in there also. And basically he becomes very close to both of them. They both serve as sort of mentor figures, though Elijah Muhammad, I think, is more like a father figure, and Malcolm X more like an older brother, and both kind of tutor him in this ideas of Islam. But Malcolm X goes to Mecca and he learns about Islam, the sort of global worldwide version, a more orthodox form of Islam. And he becomes disillusioned with Elijah Muhammad as a leader, understands some of the corruption that's going on within the Nation of Islam. And he starts to break away. And I think that he's still Cassius Clay at that time. Ali is really torn between them, and he has to make this decision of whether he's going to go with Malcolm X or stay with Elijah Muhammad. And I think it's a difficult decision for him, though he, at that moment, Elijah Muhammad bestows the name Muhammad Ali on him. And I think that that's really a factor in his decision. And he does ultimately go with Elijah Muhammad, the father figure, and really turns his back on Malcolm X. And it's something that he talks about later in his life, that it's one of his greatest regrets, the way that he turned his back on Malcolm X. And of course, Malcolm X would be assassinated soon after that. And so it's, you know, you also wonder about how much Ali was afraid of the kind of violence that also took Malcolm X's life ultimately.
And you mentioned sort of the global element, which you really weave into the story. You know, it's very much a story of America in late 20th century, but, and the way, I guess, Ali impacted events, but also their imprint on him. But that global element of the story, not just the fights that were international, but at one point you mentioned billions of people were watching the stories. You know, how do you capture this widespread, here in Australia too, the global influence and legacy?
Yeah, I don't think we appreciated, or I didn't appreciate when we undertook this project, how global his reach was. I mean, just writing into the script the idea that billions had viewed his fight, it was hard to get our heads around that. I mean, I think I understood that when he would step out of a car on a Manhattan street corner, he would draw a crowd every time. And I think he really appreciated it. I think he needed that. He needed the connection with the people. But I didn't appreciate that when he would go, say, to the Muslim world, that the whole country would come to a halt. And that it would be a national holiday, and he would bless babies, and he would speak at schools, and he would address troops. I mean, it's an astonishing thing, his reach. And that is clear right in 1964 when he goes to Africa for the first time, and he's treated like a dignitary, like a head of state when he comes already just after beating Sonny Liston to capture the heavyweight crown at just 22 years old. There's an awareness about him well beyond our shores in the United States. And that goes for the rest of his life. I mean, it's the crowds that come to the fight. It's the people who feel like he's speaking for them who don't have a voice. And it's also people who share the same faith as him, that they feel connected to him. And so even when he loses, I think, after he retires, he loses a little bit of his profile here in the United States. When he goes overseas on these various missions, everyone is very much aware of who he is. And when he does lose that sort of sense of his importance, he's stricken by Parkinson's. He's not able to get in the ring anymore. Not as many people are paying attention. In the mid-90s, he's invited to light the torch at the Olympics. And I think it's something like 3 billion people who see that. And he had some reservations, I think. He was a little bit less comfortable in his skin, and he didn't have the voice. The charisma wasn't as present as it had been across his boxing career. But when he turns up for that, everybody tunes in, and he's just sort of overwhelmed by the people's response. And he realizes, I think, at this point that in spite of the Parkinson's, he can still connect. And even though he's been quieted by it, his voice is sort of louder than ever. And so he kind of ascends to like the status of a saint at that point. And it's astonishing. His reach is into every corner. And that's something that I think we had to discover in the process of making the film.
And I wouldn't expect this to have made it into the film, but were you aware of his Australian, it's an infamous here in Australian TV history. He was at an awards ceremony and as an Australian entertainer who called him boy, like as an aside. And then he, you know, rightly was offended by that, but I guess it speaks more to the ignorance of Australia, certainly at that time. But yeah, it's quite an infamous moment in Australian TV history. Did that one come across you in your research at the Logies?
I don't know if I've seen the clip, but it's certainly, it makes sense to me, and I'm, you know, it's not, it wouldn't just be the ignorance of that particular person who was speaking to him. You know, there's certainly other examples of that in the U.S. too. And a lot of the sports writers, especially early on, you know, these sort of older white sports writers who just didn't really know what to make of him. They found him rude and inappropriate, and they didn't like the way he bragged, and they certainly didn't like that he changed his name and all of these things, you know. And so the response often to him was very, there's a clip in the film of one reporter basically saying, "Shut your mouth. Can't you just be quiet for a second?" And it's sort of, it's shockingly rude and inappropriate. It's just, I think he got that over and over. It took some time for a lot of folks like that to come around to him and to understand and respect him and what it meant for him to be bragging like that and to be proud of himself like that and just how important it was that he was doing that. But so many people did not understand or respect that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so telling who continues to use his former name, you know, for years afterwards. It's, you know, says so much about them. And on that, just the way he redefined black leadership, and I guess in some of the people you interviewed within the film, and the way I love the way they speak to his legacy. They bring, you know, the contemporary lens, and of course it connects with everything that continues to go on. But some of the quotes from your interview subjects, just speaking to his imprint on them and how that was inspiring to black leadership. Can we talk a little about that?
Sure. I think it's clear that he left an imprint on everybody he encountered. And most of the people in the film, and we didn't get into this in the film, but they shared with us on camera some encounter they had with him. And so in terms of leadership, I can give you one example that doesn't fall within the film. There's a woman named Bernardine Dorn, who is an activist, and she was studying law at the University of Chicago, and she was working for Dr. Martin Luther King. They were at a church for a gathering when they heard that an eviction was going on in the neighborhood nearby. And so these young aspiring lawyers rushed out there to see if they could bring it to a halt. And a crowd had gathered, and the police had already put the possessions of this family out on the curb. And they didn't really know what to do. But she said, you know, that moment when somebody much taller than you has sort of come up beside you and you haven't seen them yet, but you know that they're there. And she said, I turned and looked, and there was Muhammad Ali. And he had heard of this too. And she said he took off his jacket and handed it to her. He didn't know her. And then he strode up to the pile of the family's possessions, picked up a coffee table, and marched it back into the house as a group of sheriff's deputies stood off to the side watching. And it inspired everybody to come and gather the things and walk all the family's possessions back into the apartment. He came back after doing this, took the jacket from her, and was gone. And I think for me, that summed up a lot of how he was a leader. He didn't get out there in a way that some of the ministers in the civil rights movement, such as Dr. King, did and speak on behalf of the people. And he didn't consider himself a leader in the civil rights movement. But it was in many ways by action or calling attention to the plight of poor and dispossessed people. When it came to the Vietnam War, he said, why would I go 10,000 miles to fight some poor black and brown people who never gave me any trouble, right? And so that was how he led. It was also essential that he be successful in the ring too, to keep his profile up. And so I think he felt when he was boxing for all those people as well. And it helped him maintain his platform. And just to speak a little bit to what Sarah had referenced earlier, when he did speak up in the 1960s, he was doing it with sort of no precedent for what it is he had done. When Jack Johnson won the heavyweight crown in the 19-teens, there were race riots across the country, and he eventually was run out of the sport and the country by the U.S. government. When Joe Louis captured the heavyweight crown, he was told 20 years later by his white handlers, he was told, don't speak up, be polite, keep quiet, or they will find a way to take this away from you. So Ali knows that to make change, he's got to win and he's got to be defiant and he has to stick to his principles. And he does that. And part of it is the times. The country is exploding in the 60s. There is the civil rights movement is in full swing. But he's not marching with King. He's off here speaking out. He's following his faith. He's sticking to his principles. He's not concerned about how unpopular he's becoming for the stance he's taking. But he's holding his ground. And over time, we seem to catch up with him.
And to extend that then, so when the ring gets taken away from him and those years in exile, those moments, how do you think that shaped him and evolved his activism and using that moment when people hated him, to evolve as a leader and also as a boxer and just as a person?
Yeah, when he's exiled from boxing, he's by that time really despised by a huge percentage of the American population, at least. He's by that time announced that he's a member of the Nation of Islam. He's changed his name, and now he's refused induction into the military. And that's why he's stripped of his title. And he's also convicted of draft evasion and sentenced to 5 years in prison. And so it's during this period when he is appealing that decision and hoping to avoid jail, but fully expecting to go to jail and prepared to go to jail, that we see him, you know, he has this, what ends up being a 3.5 year exile from boxing. But I think what's really important about that is that he doesn't know he's ever going to get back in the ring. Here he is, the greatest boxer of all time. He is dominant in his sport. He's in his prime. And those last few fights before he is exiled, before his title is stripped and his license is taken away so he can't box anymore, he is unbeatable. I mean, you watch him and these fighters who are supposed to be the great other fighters look like amateurs in the ring with him. And it's really striking when you think about what he's giving up. And he's giving that up for principle, for his faith. And the courage of what he did is just extraordinary. I find it really moving to think about what he did there, because he was, at that time, the Vietnam War was still quite popular in the United States. And this was before people sort of knew as much as they came to know about the war. It would be several more years before so many more people came around. Obviously, there was an anti-war movement already, but it was much smaller. And he is saying, I don't care. I don't care if you hate me. I don't care if you send me to jail. There's an amazing clip in the film where he says, I will go before machine gun fire, a firing squad tomorrow before I abandon my religion. And you think about this person who is incredibly famous, incredibly successful, and unbeatable. He's going to hold the title for many more years. And what he's giving up, what he's prepared to give up, is really extraordinary. And as Walter Mosley says in the film, I think speaking to what Dave was talking about with the story about Bernardine Dorn and this eviction, you know, he talks about how Walter Mosley, the novelist, talks about how he later on said something similar to what Ali was saying about his feelings about the Vietnam War. And he didn't even realize, I thought it was my own idea. He's like, that's the kind of leader that Ali was. He was sort of planting that seed for so many people. And as the scholar Sherman Jackson says in our film about that moment where he says, I'll go before a machine gun fire, is that the example that sets is teaching people how to have that kind of courage, how to stand up for their beliefs in a way that you can only do by example, by leading, by making those choices yourself. And it's amazing. And he's off for 3.5 years. He has basically no income. He starts giving these speeches on college campuses. And in that period, I think his views evolve. He starts talking about not just his religion, but he starts speaking sort of to the anti-war movement about his feelings about the war. And it's a really interesting period for him.
Yeah. And then, you know, ultimately when the Supreme Court decision comes down, his quote then about, you know, does it change your perception of justice? But, you know, the recalling hundreds of years of inequality, but then also the prescience of knowing, well, I can't speak to who's going to be assassinated or the injustice to come. Is incredible in that moment to have, you know, at this great moment of heightened emotion for him to reflect on others who are yet to suffer is such a moving moment in the film. And I guess on that prescience, I mean, it's in a funny way, I had no idea that he predicted the rounds that his opponents would fall. But then that bigger element of prescience, were you aware that he had that kind of, you know, foresight?
Well, I think that those predictions, that they come before he first wins the title, they're sort of tied to this identity that he's creating as a young man who's quickly risen up the ranks. He's been successful at the Rome Olympics in 1960, and he's got to get a shot at the title. And he's a better promoter than his promoters are, right? And so he realizes that he's this good. If he can defeat these lesser opponents and predict the round, he's going to draw a lot of attention. He discovers that it doesn't matter whether it's negative attention or a positive attention. All attention is good attention. This is a great discovery on his part. And as he's shaping this identity, he's drawing from the wrestler Gorgeous George, who's not afraid to tell audiences, I'm so pretty. He curls his hair. He wears these glamorous robes, and he gets in the ring and he gets booed mercilessly, but people turn up to see it. And Muhammad Ali, then Cassius Clay, sees this. He also sees the way that Sugar Ray Robinson, the great middleweight, dances around the ring. He's not standing at the center and exchanging punches with his opponent. He's moving gracefully and endlessly around the ring. So Muhammad draws from that. So this, or Cassius at the time, he's drawing all these things from different spaces, and he's putting it together and creating this kind of public persona. And he's the showman. He cannot reveal that he's involved with the Nation of Islam, because he understands that they may not give him a shot at the title, this young man, if he's associated with an organization that white people are afraid of. And so all this is sort of happening at once. But he rises up the ranks, and he's able to get a match with Sonny Liston. And everyone thinks he's going to get annihilated. And he wins. And the next morning, he puts the showman personality aside, and he says the thing that becomes a kind of manifesto. It's the signature thing that he says. It's the thing that continues to inspire people everywhere to this day, which is, I don't have to be what you want me to be or think what you want me to think. I'm free to be who I want to be. And it just defines a whole era. And forever, it has given people inspiration not to worry about what others think and to go about the business of being who they feel they are. And it was so dramatic and radical at that time, coming on the heels of a Jack Johnson and a Joe Louis. And he's also stepping outside of that persona, the brash young man who's always speaking at the press, and he's predicting his fights. And he's finally saying, all that is not necessary anymore. I'm going to be the person that I want to be. And shortly after that, he announces that his name is Muhammad Ali, and he declares publicly, well, not in that order, but declares publicly that he's a member of the Nation of Islam, and his popularity plummets. But now he's the heavyweight champion, and so he's going to defend his crown. They have no choice but to let him do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And with the timeline, I'm conscious he passed, 5 years ago now. How long have you been working on this project? And did he have wind of that, if it's gone on for a long time?
Yeah, we did start talking about this and started planning to do this project 7-8 years ago. And so he was still alive when we began the project. And by then he really was not able to speak much at all. So we knew that we weren't going to be able to have a sit down formal interview with him, though we had hoped that we might be able to at least sort of visit him and film him in his day-to-day life, which I think was towards the end of his life, especially really devoted to his faith. And just to see him kind of in his space. But we actually began by total coincidence, the first interviews that we filmed were just a week or two after he passed away in June of 2016. And we initially thought that people might not want to, might not no longer be prepared to talk to us then. But in fact, the opposite was true. I think that because he had just died, everyone was particularly sort of emotional and open and ready to talk and remember him and his life. And so that wasn't as sad as that was. And we were, it was unfortunate that we'd never got the chance to actually sort of share that with him and be in that space with him. There was something nice about how people were ready to speak about him in that moment.
Yeah. And who was your first interview?
We went to Las Vegas and we filmed the sports writer Jerry Eisenberg, who is now in his early 90s. And he covered Cassius Clay from the very beginning. And he's a great storyteller. We filmed also in Las Vegas Gene Kilroy, who served as a kind of manager and friend to Ali across the 70s and into the early 80s. He sort of made all the trains run on time, was the gatekeeper. We also filmed Bob Arum, the promoter, and those were the three who play an important role in the film. And it was shortly after that that Muhammad's funeral was held, and it was like a funeral you'd have for a head of state, and that sort of stopped the country in its tracks. And there were day-long services and people commentating on it and people traveling from all over to be there, and a funeral procession like you'd have for a dignitary. And I think for us, it was, if we didn't understand the importance of Muhammad Ali to the number of people that he was important to, that ratified it for us.
I'm sure. I imagine for such a long life and for so many spheres in public life, you cast the net fairly wide to try for interviews. Did you do the interviews yourselves, and how was it, sort of a conversational style, or did you have set questions speaking to the, just, yeah, if you can talk us through the process of those interviews, so many.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we did about 50 interviews for this. Is that right? 50.
45.
Yeah. You're right. We want to cast that net wide. So we want to, you know, we always want to talk to eyewitnesses, people who were there, family members, you know, people who are really close to the story themselves when that's possible, which of course, in this case, we had some really terrific folks, you know, journalists who covered his early career, in addition to family members, two of his ex-wives, two daughters, his brother are all participated. And that really, I think, adds something to the story. All three of us directors, Dave, myself, and my dad, Ken, all did some of the interviews. And in addition to though, to those people who are the eyewitnesses, the people closest to him, we also are always looking for a variety of perspectives. So we want to, you know, we want help understanding his faith. And we want to find people who can help us understand the Nation of Islam and what it means and help us sort of relate to that in a different way. You know, for example, we also wanted a perspective that wasn't just American. And so we have the wonderful Wole Soyinka, the Nigerian poet, who both reads his poem about Ali that was written in the 80s, but also talks, you know, helps us with some of the context for the Rumble in the Jungle and the dictator of Zaire, Mobutu, who hosted that fight. And so it's really nice to have, we're always looking for a variety of perspectives. And we spent several years figuring out who those people were and collecting those interviews as part of this larger process of collecting all the material, doing research through books and newspapers, and gathering the vast amount of archival material that we could dig up for this project. You know, we had the great good fortune of having a subject who was incredibly well documented, probably among the most well documented people of the 20th century. And so there were just extraordinary amounts of footage and photographs that we could use to bring his life, you know, to life. And, you know, we collected more than 500 hours of film footage and more than 15,000 photographs. That's just what we brought into our log for our editors to work with. And that, there's plenty more out there too, but we always want to find stuff that hasn't been seen. So especially for someone as well known as Muhammad Ali, we also wanted to turn over rocks and find the neighbors' home movies that are really intimate and that haven't been seen before. And so there's some great new material in there, or at least rarely seen material too.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, what was the one that was found in someone's attic when they, moved house? What was like your oh my god moment, or were there a couple?
So the promoter Don King had commissioned a film crew to follow Ali and his entourage around in Manila for the third Frazier fight, and there were multiple cameras shooting 16mm film of the fight itself. And then the production company at some point after that folded, and an archivist in Pennsylvania went to the production company and gathered all the boxes of unused film in the late 70s or early 80s and took them to her warehouse in Pennsylvania, and where they sat for decades. And when our archival producer and colleague Stephanie Jenkins, when she got in touch with this archivist who she's worked with on past projects and told her what we were up to, the archivist said, you know, I have some boxes somewhere in the warehouse that say Muhammad Ali on them. Let me see what they are. And they turned out to be 16mm footage taken from the apron or from a slightly higher angle of this fight. Some of the footage is in slow motion, and it has all the brilliance of film, and I think shows the fight in a way that we hadn't seen it. There have been documentaries done on that fight, but there's, I think, in the beauty of it, some of the brutality of what went on that night in the ring is revealed. And I think it clarified with the depths to which these men went to defeat each other. And as Muhammad says after the fight, is the closest he ever felt to death. And so that was a discovery. We kept pinching ourselves. The reels would come back. We did a 4K transfer from the film, and we put it up, and we just kept going, this can't be real. And it was surrounded. It was from multiple angles, and you could see the Marcoses in the front row, you know, waving and celebrating the fact that they had brought this spectacle for the people. And it just, there were other discoveries like that, but I think that one sticks out as a, well, you thought you saw this fight, but wait till you see what we found.
Yeah, that is amazing. And I'm conscious we've been speaking half an hour and I haven't even asked a boxing question. And I mean, that speaks to not just my ignorance of boxing, but like, it speaks to Muhammad Ali that, yeah, there's so much to talk about before we even get to the boxing. But on that, and I mean, I watched most of the fights through my fingertips. That's wincing detail. Yeah, that one particularly. The way you frame the fights, I love it. The conversation leading up to it, but then, you know, the font and the music and like, it's okay, showtime. Can we talk about that sort of setting it up and then just letting it speak for itself?
Yeah, each fight really has its own story that goes way beyond what happens in the ring and who wins or loses or how the fight goes. And a lot of that is because of Ali himself and the way that he is, as we were saying, such an incredible promoter. And the way that he often scripts the narrative around the fight. This fight is a battle between Christianity and Islam. This fight is a sort of question of who embodies sort of black masculinity, black manhood the most, who's most authentically black. You know, he sets it up, especially with Joe Frazier in that way, or his taunting or his predicting, that all of these things bring this sort of added element to the fights. And in some cases, it's also about where the fight takes place. So when you have the rumble in the jungle in Zaire, you know, this is a dictator who is oppressing his country and who is using this fight, this spectacle, as in Manila also, to try to sort of bring this attention and glory to his country. And that's pretty complicated. You have these, you know, it's both an important spectacle in the sense that there are these two African-American men fighting here in Africa, in Zaire, and then also the fact that they are taking money from this dictator who murders his political opponents. And so there's always a really fascinating story, but you don't want that to take away from the fight itself. And I didn't come into this as a boxing fan, and I agree with you. Sometimes it's really hard to watch, you know, especially the thrill in Manila, which is just so brutal, and you worry that someone's gonna die in the ring. But I came to really appreciate the boxing and how fascinating it is and how Ali's style evolved over the course of his long career. So that in those early fights before his exile, he's incredibly fast and he uses that speed and he uses his ability to measure distance. You know, he leans back to get away from punches, which is, no one is taught to do that. He sort of invents that as a new style. And then also his speed, you know, his sort of balletic performance with his feet and how he gets around the ring. And later on, as he's a little bit older and he's been exiled for several years and out of boxing, he has to figure out these new ways to win fights because he doesn't have that speed anymore. And so there's a really fascinating arc across all of these fights too. And how is he going to be able to do it? Is he going to be able to get back to where he was before? That I think creates this fascinating narrative arc just within those fights themselves.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Joe Frazier, like that rivalry, and that's where the cruelty comes out and just that, the bravado takes a much darker turn. In depicting that, and across the board, you know, it's not a hagiography by any stretch of the imagination. So, balancing in your storytelling, bringing in those elements and that aspect of his character that, you can't shy away from in a documentary. How did you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, we're determined not to gloss over any of the flaws. And one of the great things about Muhammad is in a more sort of meditative moment towards the end of his life, he is talking about the things that he regrets, the way things ended with Malcolm X, the way that he treated Joe Frazier. And so the way that he treated the women in his life, his philandering, he's open about that, self-reflective. And for a man who expressed always so much self-confidence, and I mean, he referred to himself as the greatest long before he had done anything to deserve that title. But here he is talking about his flaws. And so we want to scrape the myth off of the whoever it is we are studying in whatever work we're doing. And we don't want to shy away from the flaws. And so he made that easier. You know, when it comes to Frazier, he seems to have overstepped. And some would say that he talked about Frazier before the fights in the way that he did, because perhaps he was the opponent he was most scared of. He would try to win a fight before they ever stepped in the ring by psyching out his opponents in the way that he talked about him. But some have said in the movie that there was a kind of cruelty to the way that he talked about Joe Frazier. And as Todd Boyd says in the film, there was something about the ultimate conscious black man using the language of white racists to describe his opponent. And it clearly stung Joe Frazier. And you could see him connecting with some of these opponents after the fact, and they all seem to understand this was done to drum up interest in the fight, to make it a spectacle, to make it about more than just the combat in the ring, all the things that Sarah was describing earlier. But Frazier couldn't forgive him because, I think as Frazier would say, I'm the son of sharecroppers. I was working in the fields by the age of 12 years old. I lived a more authentically black experience, more so than you perhaps ever saw, coming from a kind of black version of American middle class in Louisville, where you had a bicycle. You know, I was working in a slaughterhouse in my teenage years with blood up to my ankles, as Jerry Eisenberg says. You were being taken care of by a group of wealthy white businessmen in Louisville. And so this really stung Joe Frazier, and their relationship kind of never recovered. It ended up giving us one of the great sports rivalries in the history of humankind. We'll be talking about those fights forever, and there'll never be athletic competitions like them. And filmmakers and writers will be trying to find out more about what happened in those, I think, as long as we continue telling stories.
Absolutely. And late in the last episode, you know, you did, of course, bring in his illness and that late career reluctance to stop sort of the fighting long after probably he should have stopped. What do you see as that impulse to not retire, and when long past his body is allowing him to withstand?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a common challenge for athletes when your life is so defined by this thing, and there's this point when you're not old. You're not, you know, you're not ready to stop doing your, you know, I mean, most people stay in their careers much, much later, much further into their lives than athletes are able to. So I think that's a common problem. But I think for Ali, I think there's a number of reasons why he has a hard time leaving the ring. You know, a lot of it's about the attention. You know, he loves the interaction. He loves not just the attention he gets, but he loves the way, you know, it's amazing the way that he shared himself with other people so generously. And it's so clear that he got so much out of those interactions with fans, and he got so much from that attention and that love that people showed him. And so I think that that's a hard thing to step away from. There's also the financial aspect of it, that there's always, you know, more money to be made. I mean, his fight against Larry Holmes, which is, he comes out of retirement to fight Larry Holmes for, I think, $8 million. And, you know, he should not have taken that fight. It was a terrible fight, but it's hard to say no to that. And, you know, and then there's also that his sort of that self-confidence that we saw from the time he was 12 years old, that he said he was going to be the greatest and that he was going to achieve these things that no one else had achieved. And he did. And I think it made him believe in some ways, like it made so many other people believe, that there was something kind of invincible about him, that there was something like he was a superhero. He was going to be able to keep doing this thing to, as Dave Kindred says in our film, you know, he was expecting in some of these later fights It's like, he's going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. He's going to, find some way to win, even when it seems impossible. And I think it's sometimes easy to believe that's possible, even when it isn't, sadly. And so he definitely did stay on the stage too long, in the ring too long.
Yeah. And another sort of behind the scenes kind of element, how do you you share director credit with Ken Burns. How do you divide that up? Also, not breaking the news here, you're all family. How does the dynamic, do you have a bit of a shorthand that that you work to?
Well, we have a small team and we have a long timeline. And so we often work with the same folks, and that long timeline allows us to do the kind of archival research necessary to do one of these productions. As Sarah said before, there may not be a better documented figure in the 20th century. And so we have a process and a system, and it's effective. Our team does all of the work. We divide up the interviews, as Sarah said. At some point in our production timeline, we open an edit room. And often we try to find editors who we haven't worked with, who might bring a different perspective than previous editors. We tend to watch films and figure out whose work we liked and then hope that maybe they'd be interested in working with us. But once we get in the edit room and we have cuts of our movies, we all gather, we watch, we take notes, and then we have a big conversation about every single line and whether we can do it better. And we do this a dozen or 14 times across a year or 14 months or 16 months, whatever it takes. And when it comes to the three of us, we're looking for what everyone else thinks and we're taking their feedback. When we have disagreements, three is a pretty good number. There's usually two who side on one. If in the rare instance that there were disagreements, there are two who may have a compelling reason for what they're doing, and usually wins the other over. And so it's an effective way to go about it, I think. And for my part, I immensely enjoy working with the two of them. I'm inspired by their storytelling gifts and the work they do. So it makes it easy to share in the responsibility of making sure the thing comes together the way that we want it to and on time and gets off to public television and to our distributors that we work with around the world.
And Sarah, from that's great. Sarah, from your point of view.
Yes, very diplomatic.
I don't disagree. That's a good way of describing it. I think that we've now been doing this together, the three of us as collaborators, for more than a decade. And, we figured out, we're married, and when we figured out early on, I think the first thing we tried working on together was writing a treatment for the first film that we made together called The Central Park Five. And, we sort of sat down and wrote something together at a computer. And it was like, we survived that without killing each other. And so we're like, I think maybe we could make this work. And actually the wonderful thing about this kind of work, about what we do, is the nature of that collaborative process. And so it's the three of us directors, but it's also the rest of our production team, and in particular our editors. And for this film, we had four different editors, one for each episode, and then a team of assistants and apprentices. And the editors are other really important creative partners in thinking about how we shape that story. Once we've gathered all that material, and that's where our production team, our archival researchers, do incredible work. And then we get in the edit room, and our editors play a really important role in shaping what we see, in working with us on what music we're using, and on just thinking about how we're steering and shaping the story, what works and what doesn't, what's missing, what else do we have to go out and find, or how to rearrange the puzzle pieces of the story in a way that works. And so that's also a really important part of our process, is finding those amazing editors who helped us make this film.
Yeah. And you both wrote it, but I also want to talk to Keith David's narration, like his, the way he speaks to it all. How do you collaborate there? Is it all ready when he walks in to give it voice? What's the collaboration there, if there's one?
Well, it took us about 18 months to write the script, which we did while our team was searching for all the archival gems that we see in the film. When we open the edit room, and we do what we refer to as a blind assembly, which is we've got the script, we've had Ken read scratch narration, and then we've placed the talking heads where they are, and we string it out, and it plays almost like a radio play. And from there, it's as long as it's ever going to be in it. That point, it becomes a process of subtraction. But we're able to carve away a lot of it in that first pass. If it doesn't play well without the pictures and without the music, there, you know, if it plays well without the pictures and the music, excuse me, then we can keep it and keep working on it. And if it feels at that point like we can get rid of it, then we haven't spent all the time trying to shape it with the pictures and the music. And so that's a big step. From there forward, we're looking at it with, it's a picture cut with pictures and music and with Ken's voice as the narrator. And we keep writing throughout the process. We'll have a discovery, an archival discovery. We'll need to write to that. We'll find somebody that we've been searching for forever, a particular voice that offers new perspective. We'll do the interview. We'll add them in. So we're still collecting the pieces across the edit. When we get close to the end, we bring in the narrator, and we think that Keith David's voice is so beautiful. He gets the meaning of the words. I can't imagine anyone else reading our scripts. No one else has in our time collaborating with Ken. And we may have him read one pass, and then we may do pickups right towards the end. And it ends up being an effective process. And so we've been listening for Ken, who, of course, gets the meaning of all the words. And then Keith slots in. Now, when he does, his pacing is a little different. So we have to re-edit the whole movie in a small way. You know, we need to pick up a couple of frames on this picture, open it up there. And so then that we give the thing back to the editors and step away for a minute. But it's around that time where just everything seems to be converging harmonically at once. And you've been doing this thing that's two dimensional. And then suddenly there's Keith's voice, and it plays beautifully with the piece of music and the new found piece of footage. And the thing at that point starts to take flight and become a kind of three dimensional thing.
Yeah. Now, the way he gives emphasis to certain words, I wondered, is, you know, did it make you see your script in different ways at some points? And I guess maybe you spoke to it then, but with some of your interviews, the people are mentioned, or there are key moments in which they played a part, but maybe it's they don't speak to it. I'm thinking maybe people like Don King. I'm just wondering was there anyone who just didn't want to talk about certain aspects where you had to cover it then in narration, or was it... Yeah, big question, but were there moments like that where you had to cover aspects that may be a little bit prickly?
You know, I can't think of anything specific like that. You know, when we go into an interview, we definitely don't have and you asked about this before too, you know, we have a set of questions. We know what we want to talk about with that person. And our interviews are usually 2 hours long, sometimes more. And so we're always trying to cover a lot of ground, and we end up using a very small fraction of those interviews in the film in the end. And that's also something that we work out in the editing process. But we don't go in, even though we have obviously those questions and a sense of what kinds of topics we want to cover, we're not trying to get people to say particular things. You know, there's no sense. When we write the script, we don't say, and then so-and-so says this. You know, it's like the what we get from the interviews ends up also sort of shaping our script sometimes. You know, someone tells an amazing story that we hadn't heard and weren't expecting before. And that ends up, you know, sending us in that direction. And now we're going to go and talk more about this aspect of it or this moment because we have someone's brilliant thing talking about it. And so that's a big, but I can't think of a time when we had someone where it was like we needed someone to talk about something and they wouldn't. And, you know, that's also just who's willing to talk to us in general. And, you know, in the end, we find that, you know, we were happy to be able to get the family members that we got as part of the film, too. And I think that's a really important part of telling the story.
In this case, Joe Frazier and Malcolm X were not going to be able to come on. We're going to have to try to address that through narration, mm-hmm. through archival clips, in dealing with his flaws. We did have two of his ex-wives who have their own versions of what happened in their lives, and they've been public and private to varying degrees about it, and they were both incredibly generous, and we were very careful to allow them the space in the movie to speak in their own way to where things were good and where things were bad, and we wanted to be respectful of that, and we were very careful to check their accounts against what others had said, and we wanted them to own them, and we wanted to do it in a respectful manner. And so that was a tricky part of this. And we're not in the business of catching anyone red-handed when we go about this, but our allegiance is to the facts and to the truth. And so we're not going to let anybody say anything that we can't verify. And we have our ears up as people are saying this, and then we can go back and we have the time to research what's said and make sure we get it right.
Yeah, no, good point. What did you take the most from this process? And I guess, you know, just about his character and the courage of his convictions. What stood out most that maybe has impacted on you and you might take on?
Yeah, I think there are really two aspects to Ali's character, to his life, that stood out for me and that I feel like I am taking away from this. And one is certainly that courage in refusing the draft and in being just unafraid to be himself all the time, no matter the cost or the consequences. I think it's just an extraordinary thing, especially with so much at stake for him, with so much on the line, with so much money and popularity and even his freedom at stake. Just what he was prepared to do, I think, is an incredible inspiration. I think the other thing that really struck me in learning about Ali is that from the first moment we started talking about doing this project and we started telling people what we were working on, we found that it felt like everyone we talked to had an Ali story. Everyone had some way that he had touched them, whether they had bumped into him on a street corner and he signed an autograph, or even if they'd never met him, never encountered him, there was something that he had, some way that he had impacted their lives. And I think that was something I hadn't fully understood before, both in terms of the scope of his influence, but also just that way that he so generously shared himself and that he made the people he encountered in his life feel really special and feel seen and feel that love from him is an extraordinary thing. We think of him as this guy who brags and who has this big charisma and the way that other people sort of adore him. But there was something incredible and I think quite unique about the way that he spread that love around to everyone he encountered that I'm not sure I've known of another person who had quite that impact on other people.
And how about you, David?
I would echo that. I mean, that's to me really that it was astonishing how every little encounter that he had with somebody seemed to imprint in a way that they would remember every detail and they would be telling the story for decades after. And maybe just to expand on a little bit, the heavyweight champion, Michael Bend, who appears in the film and does a wonderful job of explaining what's happening in the ring, which we're so grateful for. I asked him before the taping of that interview, or when we were spending time together, how it was that where he was drawing from to be able to get in the ring and compete in this sport that is far closer to combat than to my mind than it is to athletics. And he said, you've got to draw something from within, whatever it is. It's, you know, where you came from. It's conflict with a father. It's the circumstances of your origins, you know. And we were trying to probe that, I think, with a lot of Ali's main competitors. You know, we're looking for where did Liston come from? Who was he? Why was he able to do this? Floyd Patterson, what was he drawing from? Oftentimes their stories are very similar. They come from deprivation and they draw from that as they get in the ring. Cassius Clay didn't come from the same deprivation as a lot of his opponents. And then I asked Michael, what do you think Cassius or Muhammad was drawing from to be able to do this thing that a lot of us could not imagine ever doing? And we talked about it. And I think the conclusion I came to is that he, unlike most of these other competitors, was actually drawing from outside, that he really felt like he was representing people who were poor or dispossessed, Black and brown people who weren't given the kind of rights that white people were, people all over the world who were fighting for justice in their own way, and that empowered him. You know, it was a 100,000 watt charge into him when he'd hit the ring, this commitment to doing right by them. And it sort of dovetails nicely with, in the other direction, how people were impacted by their lone encounter with him. It really went both ways. It really meant something to him to be able to move a single person, and not with a camera rolling, not with stakes that were going to result in a story in the papers, but just because that's what his purpose was here on Earth.
No, absolutely. And look, thank you. Like, I mean, it's 8 hours long, but it runs at a clip. Like, it's just, there's so much there, but the pacing is fantastic. And I'm sure that's taken many, many months, if not years, to refine. But yeah, thank you. It was a joy to watch.
Thank you.
And look, I'm a bit spoiled to be able to talk it through with you, but I really appreciate the time and could ask you a million more questions, but I'll spare you that. But thank you so much. Are you working on something else at the moment? Have you got something that you're another 5 years into?
Yes, our next project, the one we're working on now, is a biography of Leonardo da Vinci. So for something very different.
Yeah, bit of a lack of the wealth of source material.
Footage.
No, he left behind this incredible trove of diaries, these notebook pages that he's wrote in, and he scribbled these various sketches and did his studies in mechanics and in anatomy and his observations in nature. So we'll be able to use those. But boy, does Muhammad Ali get in your bloodstream, mm-hmm. and it will be hard to let go of him, especially in these recent times. He just felt very timely, and I'm sure he would have no matter the times, but as we were all stuck at home wrestling with the pandemic, and as we're having multiple pandemics here in our country, another inflection point in our endless, you know, struggle for Black liberation, Muhammad seemed like a very appropriate figure to be spending our days with. And I think that our team found inspiration in working on this.
Yeah, it absolutely shows. Thank you so much. It's truly a treat to talk to you both.
Great talking with you.
Thank you.
So there you have it, Sarah Burns and David McMahon talking all things Muhammad Ali. It's such a great documentary. I can't recommend this enough. And as I said, it screens on SBS Sunday nights across 4 weeks and will be available as a box set to stream at SBS On Demand. And yeah, as I said, it's a fantastic binge. So that about wraps it up. Thank you for joining me on the playlist. As mentioned, I'm going to be back to bring you more of these companion interviews to some of the great shows and movies we've got coming up in the coming weeks. If you like this, go ahead and rate, review and subscribe. It helps others to find the show. And look, reach out and tell me what you've been watching. Obviously, I've been watching a lot of Muhammad Ali, and also tell me who you'd like to hear more from. I'm keen not to just focus on what's new. If people are up for it, I'd love to revisit some past shows and movies with their makers too. And I'm going to be casting the net wide for interviews. So give me some ideas of things you've been watching, and hopefully we can bring some interviews to deepen that experience. Anyway, reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at anythingbutfifi. I'm always doom scrolling there. So yeah, hit me up and tell me what you've been watching. As always, the playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot, who gets my eternal thanks, and we'll be back. So until next time, thanks for listening.